Mason, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful March day in Colorado Springs, and business is great, and everything is going pretty well right now. So, knock on wood. How are you doing?
Yeah, I was gonna say, be careful. That probably means something's gonna go wrong tomorrow, but such is life. So, anyways, today's show was pretty interesting. So we had Kevin Corsini, owner of Red Barn Home Buyers, on the show, and you all might be familiar with his brother Ken Corsini, who's been on HGTV with his wife for years and years, Flipper Flop Atlanta. And so, TV show aside, they own one of the fastest growing franchises in the country, Red Barn Home Buyers, with over 87 members in less than 2 years. And Kevin's background is really interesting because he is in high or was in higher education for 20 plus years, has a PhD, he's been a professor, dean of a med school, and president of a college before the real estate days. And so he's bringing that experience along with his brother Ken's experience actually flipping houses to build this real estate franchise model. And they're adding 4 to 6 new members every month, which is no easy task. So this is a great interview for anyone who wants to learn about managing people, screening people, and ultimately building a business. Anything you'd like to say on that, Mason?
Oh yeah, we had a blast with this, and I think that Kevin was able to really talk about his experience and both as a professor and as a student within higher education, how that applies to those of us that are in the entrepreneurial world. And the franchise model with a real estate investing company is just fascinating. It's different than what I've seen, different than what Dan's seen, and I think you guys are going to get a lot of value from this show. So let's bring Kevin on in.
Welcome to the Big Picture Blueprint. I'm your host, Dan Habercost, along with Mason McDonald. And we're going to discuss all things land, real estate, and business in general with all kinds of exceptional people. Let's get started.
Kevin, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I am doing fantastic for a Tuesday.
That's what we love to hear. And to jump right in with a question. So, Kevin, you've been in higher education for 20 plus years, or you were in higher education for 20 plus years. In the entrepreneurial space, I feel like there's this divide and debate where some people think college is a waste of time, it is a waste of money, and you're better off just going out and learning and starting your own business. And then there's the other side of it that thinks college is fantastic to help you learn how to think differently and how to operate in a professional environment. What is your opinion?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, I think higher education in particular is one of those rare fields where people don't want to get what they paid for. They don't want to get their money's worth. I can't tell you how many college students I had who wanted to, use ChatGPT or chat, or cheat or copy another person's paper. That so many students, the interest isn't about learning, it's about acquiring a grade. And I think that's very unfortunate because people spend literally hundreds of thousands of dollars and come out the other side, not necessarily better for it because they did just enough to get the grade that's going to go on the transcript. And I think as we think about education, maybe particularly higher education, but education in general should be at its core transformational. That any education that I am engaged with, whether it's a second grade class at the local public school, whether it's a med school, whether it's Sunday school at a church, it does not matter. Any educational context at its core should be transformational. It should change the trajectory of a person's life. And so as a professor, if I'm in front of a class or on a Sunday, if I'm in church or if I've got my kids at home, anytime I'm engaged in education, it really should be about changing the trajectory of someone's life, even if it's just by a degree or two. And I've got a PhD, and I can tell you that there are classes when I go back and look at my transcripts or go through my files here, I have written phenomenal papers that got stellar grades that I don't remember anything about. Like, I didn't remember the prompt. I didn't remember writing the paper. I don't even remember the class or the professor. I mean, it's sad. And I look back and I was like, man, that was really good stuff. But I don't remember anything about it. And so in my mind, was that really transformational? Now, I had classmates that challenged my thinking that really did change me. And that was. And so I think we have to think about education in a different context of, am I engaged in something that changes the trajectory of my life? And yeah, I think there's a lot of people that go through undergraduate, graduate, and it didn't change a thing except for their pocketbook, right? With the balance in their bank account. And so I think it really is about What am I learning? How am I changing as a person? And am I leveraging those opportunities to really grow and change that makes me a better person, you know, down the road? And that's not a cut and dry answer for everyone. Well, be an entrepreneur, go start your own business versus, hey, go into education and learn some stuff. It's about shaping who you are so that you have a preferred future, right? Where you want to land. And so I think it's really essential to look at yourself and say, am I a good candidate for college? Am I going to learn? Is this really going to change the trajectory and help me land in a better spot? Or am I just doing this to get my union card to grow, you know, join the grown-up world? And I think some people have to think, maybe I'm not. In fact, I talked to a guy just last week, really great guy. I've known his dad in the university context for a long time. And he knew me. He was just like, I'm not a good candidate for college. He started a business when he was a teenager. He's graduated into bigger businesses. He's, you know, multimillionaire, very successful, but very well grounded. You know, he was a lifelong learner. And so he's just learned in every context he could be in. I think the danger for, and see, was one prompt, guys, and I'm running with it. The danger with an entrepreneurial mindset is where I don't need to go to college. I'm just going to start my own business. The danger is that it potentially lands us in a really narrow lane where I'm going to do this business. I'm going to grow my business. All of a sudden that becomes a really narrow lane of I'm really good at this one thing or this one thing that I'm doing. And I think in life, one of the tasks of higher education, college and university, is to help people get a broader lane. Read poetry, read history, you know, learn, you know, bathe your mind in the, you know, the liberal arts, so that when you go out and become an accountant or you start a real estate business or you start a family, there's a breadth to your life that it makes for a richer life. You know, and I think that's part of the challenge is with the entrepreneurial mindset is being a lifelong learner and allowing your horizon to expand to take in more and more. Because one of the jobs of higher education is teaching people to become a lifelong learner so that once they get the degree, once they graduate, once they've gone across that stage, they're still hungry to learn more across a broader spectrum. And I've said enough. I'll pause right there. That's
mic drop moment. Podcast over. No, Kevin, that was a fantastic response. And there's a decent amount I want to unpack there and chat about, because Dean and I have moderately different opinions, not about learning, but about higher education. And I think that, Kevin, you hit on a lot of points of one towards the end, talking about the liberal arts approach, where so many people are like, no, liberal arts are the worst part of college. And up until the 70s, liberal arts was college.
That's right.
You go in and you change the way you're thinking through classroom discussions and meeting peers from different walks of life throughout the entire world, depending on the university that you're going in, and being able to study poetry and literature and philosophy and history is how you were able to see and change the way that you think from the small bubble that you grew up in. And second, and kind of your first point that you were making, at the end of the day, what you're putting in is what you're going to get out of it. You or your parents or the federal government is spending a tremendous amount of money for you to develop this higher education, and it can either be used for transforming the way that you think and act and behave in the world, or giving you the piece of paper that will allow you to get the job that you want or teach you some moderate technical skills to learn. But if you go in and recognize, hey, I'm going to really learn and really devote my time to the social efforts of, I think the friends I made and the social connections I made in college was one of the most important parts. And then grad school is the technical skills. But I think just being able to really recognize that whether it's within education or within business or within a corporate role, you get in what you put out for the most part. And that's where it starts. But I know, Dan, I want to hear your thoughts on this too.
Yeah, Kevin, so for Mason's earlier comment, I would be more the type that my biggest financial regret was going to college. They didn't know anything. They were in a little bubble, and I learned about business and life by running someone else's business. And so, of course, I shouldn't take that experience and broaden it, assuming all colleges are the same, but I definitely, and I graduated with a 4, mind you. So I don't know. I did not have a good experience, but a point you made about learning about multiple industries you mentioned poetry and history, and that's something I took away from Charlie Munger's book. I'm blanking on the name now, but reading science, reading history, and often you find that there are lessons and things you can learn from all these different spaces that are applicable in business and in life in general. And I have found that to be the case. I've always been a prolific reader. History and science especially tend to be really useful. So you made a lot of good points there. Before we transition, do you have anything else you want to say on that?
I would just say, I think part of the question about, you know, pursuing an entrepreneurial life versus, early versus going to college, you know, or going to college or university is, you know, I'm sure some listeners are like, well, do I really have to go to college to read poetry? I don't need to go to college to read poetry or to read history or to broaden my... No, you don't. You absolutely don't. But will you? I think that's, just knowing ourselves, you know, will we? And is it possible that we will encounter, whether those are professors or other students, that will introduce things to us that we never would have thought of introducing ourselves to? And so putting yourself in a context around other people, again, to learn and grow and become, you know, more than what maybe you would anticipate it. So am I an advocate for college? I think college and university has its place. I think the bigger question, and I'm not sure if it's one to address in this podcast or not, is college or colleges and universities accomplishing that mission today the way they were 20, 40, 60 years ago? And I think tragically, to a large extent, the university and college system has become something very, very different. And for that, it's regrettable, but you do see that just more and more. We're not broadening the horizons of our young people. We're not helping them think more critically. We're not helping them to create and build. It's become something very different. And I'll just leave it at that.
We're on the same page there, Kevin. And I think just with anything, you have to remember that colleges and universities are their businesses. Mm-hmm. And while they have a mission of educating the youth and providing different ways to think about things, at the end of the day, their purpose is to make money for the investors and have a huge endowment to invest and that sort of thing. And on your idea of, are you going to read history and philosophy and poetry if you don't go to university? Yeah, absolutely. Why not? Dan is one of the most avid readers I know on very complex topics with no relation to his degree, but it's the comparison I draw sometimes is having a discussion with a professor about Dostoevsky that has studied it their entire lives as versus having it with someone else that read one book, Notes from the Underground, one time. It's a different conversation, just like the part-time realtor that tries to show one home a year as versus the person that's in the grind 80 hours a week. But it's fun, and it's a fun topic to discuss, especially with those of us that have, you know, graduate level degrees or, you know, some sort of higher level education that are also in the entrepreneurial space. And I think we will not spend the whole episode talking about higher education, Kevin, and I'll let Dan transition us into the entrepreneurial world.
I'll just say one last thing, because you referenced talking to a professor about, and I think that is, for me, was one of the most valuable things as I pursued, you know, my various degrees. When I was not a student at the undergrad. I went to the University of Georgia, was on the 5-year plan, and had a great time, but I was not a stellar student. Really wasn't until I went on to do graduate and doctoral work that I really got a hold of enjoying the classroom. But as a graduate student, one of the things that I did that I really most cherish is I, each semester, would choose two professors that I was in their class that I wanted to get to know. And I went to each of them. Actually, that's not true. It wasn't two. I did three. I would do three. And so what I would do with those three that semester would go and schedule one meeting with them out of class, you know, to meet with them in their office once a month. And I added almost like a time slot to my calendar. So I knew, hey, my classes were Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday. And I just added a slot. Okay, so Thursdays at 2 or whatever time it was, that's my go visit a professor hour. And first week of the month, I went and visited professor number one. Second week of the month, I visited professor number two. Third week. And professors ate this up. They loved it. Man, a student wants to come meet with me outside of class. And it wasn't to get help with homework. It was just to talk about life, talk about the subject matter, just to get to know them. Why did they want to do this? And then the fourth one I would, you know, use as a free slot to meet with whoever. But I just treated it as part of my schoolwork. And those were some of the most valuable times. So just out of class, talking to a professor about life. And then in the next semester, I'd either renew their contract and say, yeah, I'm going to keep meeting with this guy another semester, or I'm going to go meet a couple new guys. And so by the time I graduated, I knew several professors very well. I'd been in their homes, you know, I'd gotten to know them, became mentors in my life. that was every bit, if not more, valuable as a young student as what I learned in the classroom, was just getting one-on-one time, building a relationship, getting to know who they were. And that carried over into my doctoral work as well. I mean, I pursued a relationship with my professors because I found that transformational nature of education occurred in, most often in the context of a relationship, more often than in the context of lecture. And that's, for every student, that's available right now. Go get to know your professor. Get to know, you know, the people that are teaching you, because they will eat, they've given their life to impacting students. And that made such a difference for me. And I've seen that, you know, in my own students through the years as well. And again, I know that's not what the podcast is about, but you guys asked the question. You got me down this rabbit path.
All this is great, Kevin. And I'm glad we started with this. And you make a good point there where the one-on-one time is invaluable. And I'll tell you, where I got into land and development is because of a one-on-one relationship with an older friend who taught me a lot about real estate, most of what I know. And so agreed strongly, just different context where I met him. Yep. So all that to say, you have the background in education, which has, I'm sure, proven valuable now that your brother and you own Red Barn Home Buyers and you're franchising the home flipping model. So not only do you have to be an expert operator and really know your business, but now you have to teach it to all these new franchisees, which is not easy. I think that is the highest level of expertise, is not only being able to implement something yourself, but be able to teach others how to do the same. So I think I read on your website, you're taking on,
from being an educator yourself in colleges and universities around the country to now owning Red Barn Home Buyers with your brother, Ken. You have to be able to teach others, and that's the highest level of mastery, is not only being able to implement and operate yourself, but being able to show others how to. And I saw on your website 4 to 6 new franchisees a month. That is no easy task. So can you talk to us about how you guys are scaling Red Barn Home Buyers and teaching others so efficiently and at a scalable level?
Yeah, great question. And we are adding about 4 to 6 a month. I mean, that's the pace we're on right now. You know, as I think, you know, the people that we have joining our franchise, I liken it to education. When people ask, well, you were a college president, you were in higher ed, now you're doing real estate. How in the world are those, you know, relatable? And in my mind, it's very comparable because you're equipping a person for a new profession. You're helping equip a person for, typically a new industry or to scale up where they're at. And it is highly related, where you are providing an educational component that leads to a praxis component that leads to, you know, a preferred future. For us, and we are growing at a fast pace, it's got a few different components. You know, one for education has to do with just content, curriculum. And so we've got probably at this point 60 to 80 hours of content that a person goes through. We've chosen to do that in an asynchronous model. And so it's video on demand. Students can, or our franchisees can go through it at their own pace, with live support. So anytime a person needs to pause, they can rewind, they can watch it 3 times if they want, they can watch it with a spouse or a partner. And then anytime they land on something that they've got a question, boom, they've got somebody they can reach out to and say, hey, I was watching this last night and this didn't make a whole lot of sense. But we feel that for content, just providing a curriculum, the asynchronous model has worked really well. And there's actually great research, you know, for online education that outcomes are commensurate with what you find in the classroom as well. But that can't just be it. It can't just be, hey, watch all these different videos. There is a relational component as well. And so for each of us, each of our franchisees is assigned a coach, a deals coach. It's somebody who's been through our program. They're doing deals on a day-to-day and a week-to-week basis. And so they're assigned a coach that works with them, somebody proven in the field. And then they're also assigned a mentor. Our mentors are people who don't focus so much on the deals as much as they do on building your business. I think we've encountered a lot of folks in our sector that, man, I'm doing a deal, then I'm doing a deal, then I'm doing a deal. I got these 3 different deals, but they haven't paused to think about, I should be building a business. Like what I'm doing here should be repeatable to such an extent that in time I can sell this to someone else. And so we have curriculum, we've got relationship with mentors, with coaches. We've got folks in our office as well, like the marketing department and contracts, and then also in accounts that build relationships, work with people. So we're coming alongside them also. And then once they get out into the field, right, you need to have a sense of community. So a student launches, they've been through the curriculum, they're building a relationship with their coaches and their mentors. They launch. Well, it can be easy when you live in, you know, Cleveland, Ohio, to feel like, am I out here doing this on my own? Like, who else is doing this? What is this like? And so we've established community as well. And so we meet at all the franchisees. We meet every single Tuesday in what's called Digging for Deals. It gives very much a community feel for people. And typically what we do is it's one part show and tell and one part working session. Two of our franchisees every single week will bring a live deal that they're right in the middle of. And it could be any phase, you know, through acquisition, maybe in the midst of a flip, maybe working on an exit strategy and some show and tell. Hey, this is what I'm working on. This is what I'm struggling with. This is what's gone well. The membership then can speak into that. Oh, hey, I've done this before. I've run into this. Well, have you thought about that? And those have been proven to just be outstanding. Our folks absolutely love those because it's a chance of, hey, I'm not in this alone. I've run into that before. Or, hey, heads up, this is maybe something I'm going to run into next week when I'm over on Oak Street. And so you get a real sense of community feel of there's some universality. Hey, we're all doing this together. We all are running into pitfalls. And maybe I had a discouraging week, but so did they. And this is how they're overcoming it. Or, man, I got a big win. I can't wait to share those with the other folks that are in Red Barn Homebuyers. And so in that context, right, you're providing a sense of community with other members. And we have a really tight-knit, high-caliber group of folks. You're providing coaching and mentorship to provide direction and corrective action, right, where it's necessary. And then also curriculum. It can't just be one. And I feel like those three elements combined help a person go from being a librarian in Oregon, which is a true story, to moving to Massachusetts to be closer to family. And her very first deal, she netted over $100,000. No background in real estate whatsoever, but it was curriculum, relationship with leadership, and then also being in a community where she was able to learn. So that's the way we've structured it to help people go from zero to, hey, I'm actually doing this.
Do you hear about the deals that Dan and I are doing and feel like you lack the capital or knowledge to do them yourself? Allow us to be your partners in this and visit gupland.com to learn more about how we can provide you with all the capital to complete land transactions, as well as the expertise and guidance for you to create your own business. Visit us at gupland.com.
And I just want to highlight what you said. The curriculum alone doesn't do it. They need the support, the mentorship, the community. And it sounds like you've done an exceptional job of layering in that from the beginning and different levels of support from people who have been doing it a long time, but then also people who are maybe a year ahead of them and going through the same program and learning process. So that's really cool. And I think even training employees in my own business, that gets me thinking about how I could do that better and support them better. So that's great. Thank you.
And yeah, Kevin, on that, you look at the franchise model and you think of, okay, what companies have executed the franchise model the best? And Chick-fil-A. And the becoming an owner-operator or franchisee in Chick-fil-A is difficult. They get tons and tons of applications. And so it's obviously a two-way interview. You guys are incentivized by being able to build a network, build a community, and obviously receive some sort of income from having the franchisee. But also just in business in general, it's you probably are doing some sort of criteria or screening for your franchisee to make sure it's a good fit for them. Could you speak to maybe what that looks like a little bit on the front end?
Yeah. Great question. So we have a recruiting process. I can't say it's like Chick-fil-A's. I mean, it's so hard to become an owner operator in Chick-fil-A. My brother-in-law is actually an executive, one of the directors at Chick-fil-A. So I'm very familiar with that work. And actually my brother, a little plug for my brother, he actually, before Red Barn was started, went through the whole process. It was given the opportunity to be an owner operator of a Chick-fil-A. And he was going to have to move. I can't remember if he was going to go to Nashville or someplace. And so this was a long time ago to me. And he said, no, I'm not going to do the Chick-fil-A thing. I'm going to do real estate instead. So he was at that fork in the road. You know, for us, it's a family business. Our name is all over it. And so when you're awarding a franchise, it's somebody who's going to represent Ken and Kevin Corsini. I mean, it's somebody who they're going to be out in their city and their town, and they're an ambassador of something that we've worked really hard to build. And so being selective is important, really, really important to us. Right now, in any given month, I probably have about 300, 275 to 350. I mean, kind of in there, about 300 people that express interest in joining Red Barn Home Buyers. And for recruiting, we go through a five-step process before we'd ever get to a spot where we would offer. Typically, the first thing we do is introductions. We've got a couple of folks that help with that, of just meet a person, express, hey, get to know you, get to know us a little bit. This is what it is. This is what it's not. You know, we weed out the folks who are like, I want to be on TV. I want to be on that HGTV show. It's like, that's not what this is. Second step then is program details. We'll meet a second time and go through, hey, here's what's all included. This is, you know, what the program looks like. Here's what we do. Here's what we expect of you. If that goes really well, then we'll schedule a third meeting. The third meeting is what's called disclosures. As a franchisor, I'm required to provide a franchise disclosure document, affectionately known as an FDD. If you were looking at an H&R Block, a Molly Maid, or a Pizza Hut, they would be required to provide you with their FDD. Right? And ours is a huge, long document. It's 160 pages. Tells you everything about us. I mean, it gets everything out on the counter. You know, there's nothing hidden. There's no hidden fees. There's no gotcha. It's all out there. And so typically a person will spend a week or so with that. Oftentimes they'll review it with an accountant or an attorney. They come back and then we talk through that. Are they still comfortable? Is this something, you know, any questions we can answer? If that goes well, then the fourth step is formal application. Formal applications by invitation only. And so if I feel like, yeah, this person's a good fit, we've been able to answer their questions, that is something they're still interested in, then I'd ask them to fill out a formal application. That's our chance to get to know them better. There's a background screen. Ken and I then spend time together with them. And we're kind of in a franchise agreement arrangement. You're really working towards like a marriage. Like, I'm signing a document that says, man, I'm committed to seeing this person be successful. So I want to make sure they're a good fit for us. They're in an area where we believe they're going to be successful. I've got to report every year, you know, how well they're performing. And so it's selective. And so that fourth stage is formal application. We still feel good about it. They still feel good about it. Then we go to a fifth stage, which is called decision. And that's where any other concerns, hesitations, anything else we need to get out of the table. And it's only after that fifth stage that there's a fork in the road. And it's either, hey, we'd like to, you know, offer to award you a franchise, and they're making a decision. Yes, I'd like to sign. Or, you know, sometimes it's, hey, we've exhausted our options here. We've looked at everything. You know, I don't know that it's the best fit. And we shake hands and we go our separate ways. And typically that shake hands, go separate ways can happen in any one of those five steps. But by the time you get to signing a franchise agreement, we have a high degree of confidence that they're representing us well, that there's a recipe for great success together. And so, you know, it's a drawn out process. If I have somebody come in, this is absolutely what I want to do. This is what I want to do. It's like, all right, well, let's spend the next 6 weeks together and see if it's a fit or not. I mean, it's a process to get to the finish line.
I love that. I think within the real estate and investing community, there's so many gurus that you won't even finish a statement before they say, hey, and I have a course for you to sign up for $5,000. And they will take anyone as long as they have a pulse and the ability to pay them that money for that. So I love the two-way street. I love how much vetting is going on. And I think the point that you're making is, yeah, it's great. Theoretically, you could expand the business a lot more, but your name is on it and you don't want you and your brother's reputation being negatively looked on through the franchisees. But question on that,
right?
Why the franchise model? Why did you guys choose to do the franchise model for this? Because it's such a great model and it's so cool and it's relatively unique-ish for this space. So I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, great question. So if we rewind in time, there was a season of Red Barn where there was a coaching program. I mean, if you go back, was it 2018? There was a high-level coaching program, real expensive, a lot of rah-rah, got people signed up, had a lot of people signed up for it. And what we found is that, and built it well. I mean, it was a good curriculum, put coaches in place, and it was a, you know, static fee up front, and we're going to help you do this. And after about a year, 95% of the people or so weren't doing it. Like, we'd taken a lot of money from a lot of different people and found that after about a year, maybe 5% were actually out there doing it. Most people just didn't, they'd spent a lot of money and just didn't follow through. And that didn't sit well. The idea, hey, we've taken a lot of money from these folks and they're not doing it. And so that didn't sit real well. Hey, we need to do this differently. And the thought was, people need handholding. They need accountability. they need to be forced to spend money on marketing and lead gen, because a lot of folks will spend, you know, $60,000 on a coaching program, but they won't spend $2,000 a month on lead gen. So you got to do that to make things work. And so the thought was, in a franchise model, really, we started with a business in a box approach. We looked at biz op licensing and really discovered, with a federal trademark, with the expectations we were putting in place, really landed in the definition of a franchise. But we wanted to do the handholding of, no, we're going to make sure you're successful, and you're going to do the lead gen, and we're going to do follow through. We're going to do this together for 2, 3, 4, 5 years and help you do those first. Cause if you can do one deal, you can do two deals. And if we can help you do two deals, you know, you can do five deals. And by the time you're doing 5 or 6 deals, you know, you can do 5 or 10 deals, right? But a lot of folks just need that accountability and handholding up front to be disciplined, to say, how many appointments did you set up? How many offers have you made this month? How, you know, what are the KPIs? And you don't get that in a coaching model. And a lot of folks just need the discipline. The other thing with coaching, I think we found, was people drown in information. I mean, there's just so much out there in so many different ways. And it was like, let's narrow this down. Here's the process. Here's what you're going to do on Tuesday. Here's what you're going to do on Thursday. Here's the A, B, C, D. Here's the system you're going to follow. And then in addition to that, for us, there's a real value in community building. It was, let's do this with people that we like. Let's choose people that we like, that we believe are going to be successful. And let's do this for a long, long time together. And that's probably been one of the most rewarding things that we anticipated, but now we're experiencing, is doing this with people you just really enjoy. You love getting on the phone, getting on the Zoom, meeting people and saying, hey, we're doing this together. It's very rewarding to see, having built a system and see it work in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Erie, Pennsylvania, and Port St. Lucie, Florida. And it's like, you look over all around the country, it's like, this works. Like, our system that was built in Woodstock, Georgia, works all across the country. But when you're doing it with good people and you hear them say, I mean, literally, I have people tell me, you have no idea, guys, this has changed my life. It's changed my family's life. I never could have done this without you guys. How rewarding that is for us. It's not just about the payday. It's like, man, we are seeing people's lives change because of that. And I don't think that would have been possible in the coaching model, in the guru model. This is a, hey, we're going to do this in a marriage relationship. Like, we're in a relationship. We've signed on the dotted line. We're contractually bound to each other for a long period of time. And that's been really rewarding. And I would point to, we do an annual summit. And we haven't been around 2 years. I mean, mind you guys, May will be 2 years when we awarded our first franchise. So it hadn't even quite been 2 years. So this last September, we had our first summit where we invited, you know, all the members to fly into Woodstock. And it was kind of funny because leading up to it, we had this moment of, we've chosen all these people because we like them. And it's really cool to see them be successful, but they haven't met each other yet. Like what's this going to be like when they're all in a room together? Like, what, you know, they don't even know each other. And so we're going to have a giant room full of people that have never met each other. Is this going to be awkward? Like, what's going to happen? And it was the best. I mean, so we had a mixer that first Thursday night. And imagine, I mean, you've got dozens and dozens of people show up for the first time, husbands, wives, kids, and everyone is an absolute stranger. And it was just immediate. Immediately, they got into huddles, they got into groups, they start sharing stories. Well, where are you? Where do you live? And how does it? And it was a great night. And really, we got to the end of the night, we had to kick everyone out. It's like, go back to the hotels, guy. We got a long couple of days together. They just click so well. And I think it's a real high caliber group of folks. And it was just cool to see, we chose people we like and they really like each other. And the whole weekend was that, where they just, every time we starting a session, it's like, everybody, come on, get in your seats. We got to go through this next session. Or every night, kicking people out. And out of that session this past fall, the summit, is when our members were like, hey, we need to do this more often. We need to get together more often. And so we started the Tuesday Digging for Deals. We started a social site. We're doing it every 6 months, we're doing regional events. And that community for us doing the franchise has just been really valuable. We wanted that. We wanted to do this together with other people across the country, as opposed to, hey, read my book, go through my curriculum, and you can be successful too. It's like, nah. I want to celebrate that big deal in Denver, you know, when Pete lands. I want to celebrate, you know, when a person's building out a rental portfolio in the middle of, you know, Illinois that they never knew that they could. I want to be a part of those wins over the next 5, 10 years with people all across the country. And for us, there's that intrinsic value that comes out of a franchise relationship that you're not going to get in a coaching context.
I mean, that's awesome. And I think the community building aspect of it, and being able to take on people that you like enough to represent you and your brand, and you get to see the hive mind effort and the collaboration, the community that comes from it. And I imagine that you have a model that works, that's very successful, and you have all these different players in different parts of the country, and will probably, you bring them in and they increase your business and add value to your business. So they think about things differently and approach things differently. And that's just cool. And I know I saw Dan have a visceral response to something that you said around spending $60,000 on courses and coaching, but not on anything else. And I want to hear Dan's thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, it just resonates with me. So having, 6 years ago started my business, that's probably the biggest thing that has held me back, Kevin, is it took me a long time to get through my thick skull, the difference between spending money and investing money. And I definitely would be further along if I had spent or invested more money in marketing sooner. So that's why I definitely responded there, because that's me.
Well, it's a requirement. When I'm recruiting someone, it's like, you need to plan on, hey, at least $3,000 a month. That's a good spot to start marketing. And people choke on their tongues. They're like, that's more than my mortgage. I'm going to have to spend $3,000 a month on marketing. It's like, yeah. And then I have to walk them through this. You know, if you spend $3,000 on marketing, these are the sort of leads that you should anticipate. This is, your version. And you kind of walk them through the math. You do this, and you can just land one deal in 6 weeks. Man, that's the best $3,000 you ever spent. You got to look at it that. It's the fuel for the engine. I mean, you don't spend, $75,000 on an F-150 and check on putting gas in it. It's like, that's what you bought it. I mean, you got to put gas in that. So, but it is, that's the barrier. That is the barrier to newbies in this industry, of getting them to realize you got to pay for it.
No, 100%. Having those built out KPIs and taking them through the funnel and seeing the return that they're going to get on it, knowing that you're getting that return, that definitely is helpful. So you made a lot of good points there, but we have quite a few more questions we want to get through. So one of the things that I really wanted to ask, because, my brother lives here in Colorado Springs, and you started this business with your brother, and I couldn't imagine he and I running a business together. We're so different. And so can you talk a bit about that, how you've divided responsibilities, how that's gone? Has there been challenges and conflicts around that? What's it like running a big business with your brother?
Yeah, with Red Barn Home Buyers, there has not been any conflict. I think, I'm in my 50s now. He's not in his 50s yet. He's still young. But I think, we're kind of far enough down the line where egos are kind of put to the side, or kids are older. It's like, hey, let's make this successful together. And so I hadn't been a lot of headbutting or, it's not like either of us are struggling to pay the bills or something. There's not a high stress environment. This is fun. I don't know how to put it. This is a fun business. This is something we're enjoying to do together. And as far as dividing the responsibility, I think it's just recognizing you got to put your egos at the door. My brother's on TV, right? My brother's got TV shows. He's got, when I go, it's weird. If you guys have, imagine going other parts of the country and people just walking up and recognizing them. You just got to get used to it, right? And so for me, it's like, great. When we do training, coaching, we're doing promote, you go to our website, you will not see my picture. You will see Ken and Eva plastered all over the place. And I just have to, I'm at peace with that. It's like, yeah, that's what makes sense for this business. He's got a lot more experience in the real estate world and a lot more connections than I do. I'm great with that. And I've got, experience in higher education and training people and building communities. And so I think it's just recognizing, okay, where do our strengths lie? Who does what? And it's fluid. The truth is, it's fluid. When we started out, he was president and I was CEO. But sometimes it feels like it's swapped back and forth. I'm more involved on the recruiting side up front. I got a PhD it's counseling, professional counseling, human behavior. And so I feel like I've got a pretty good read on folks. He's more involved on the marketing side, lead gen side. But on a day to, I end up being much more involved on the legal side. He ends up being more involved with new product development. But he and we talk throughout the day. And so it just kind of varies. It's very fluid relationship, but we would not make for good reality TV. There hadn't been any conflict so far. No, not so far. I mean, it's gone really well. And I think part of it is because it's fun. Like, we're just having a lot of fun doing this together. And it's not, oh gosh, I've got to make this work, or I'm not going to be able to pay my bills this month. It's like, Man, let's just have a good time, Bill.
Sure. There's two things I wanted to pull out of that. Number one is it sounds like you've pretty effectively divided it where you own certain things and he owns certain things and tends to make the decisions around those things respectively. And then number two, I love what you said about, you know, checking the ego at the door when you're having conversations about business. There's no ego involved, and that's essential. Guys, you know, Mason and I obviously do business together. Sometimes we don't agree on everything, but I think we too have pretty effectively are able to just put the ego aside, listen, and make a decision that's most rational, not bringing any of our personal feelings, emotions, or egos into it. So really, really important. But as a follow-up to that, is there anything you can say, you know, from your success working with your brother, any advice you can give us or our audience about effectively selecting a business partner and how to set expectations for success?
Yeah, you know, a couple of things. One is a common set of values, I think, is really important. Understanding what is important to, you know, understanding myself well enough to know, hey, what's important to me? And then identifying somebody who's like, is this important to them as well? If, for example, one of the things that came out, you know, so we collect royalties. We don't have commissions. We have royalties. And as this sort of grew and all of a sudden our royalties started taking off, Ken brought up, he said, you know what, we need to, he oversees a nonprofit organization that provides money for kids who are going through cancer. His son went through cancer. And so they've got an organization called Rockstar Kids. And he's like, we should be putting money towards Rockstar Kids to help support that nonprofit that supports, you know, young kids. I think there are a lot of business partners that would be say, well, you can do that, but you're not going to take money out of the business to do, you know, to do a charity for kids. I'm not doing this for a charity. I'm doing this, you know, to make money. You can support that, you know, cancer kids, but not out of my business. But for me, it's like, yeah, totally. That absolutely makes sense. You know, I spent weeks in the hospital with my nephew, Rocco, right? It's like, yeah, we absolutely should do this. But that came out of a common set of values. And I think, I would say, if not on a weekly, at least a couple times a month, you hit value proposition type decisions where it's like, where are we going to do with it? How are we making decisions regarding how we spend our money or what we do with our membership or what the future, you know, what the preferred future looks like? And I think those are born out of values. And so there has to be a good value alignment. Why are we doing this business? What does success look like? What are the things that we're going to celebrate? What are the things that we're going to avoid that really are important to both of us that we're going to avoid? And then secondly, identifying as a business partner, somebody that you can, you complement each other, that you need to know where your blind spots at. So what am I not good at that this person will complement me? And my brother, you know, for Ken and I, there are a lot of ways that we complement each other, but there's a lot of overlap. And so we've had to hire to folks. He and I we're both eternal optimists. We always feel great about the future. You know, it's going to be amazing. And so we've had to hire some folks that are a little more pessimistic. They would say they're realistic. And if Ken and I both know, they're just pessimists. Yeah. But I think as a business partner, just recognizing, hey, in what ways do we complement each other and how will that make us stronger? And that does help going back to checking your ego at the door. Just recognize, yeah, I'm not really good in this area. Like, you take the lead. I recognize you probably know better than I do. And so I think that helps. That lends itself to a stronger partnership.
That's great. And I think what Kevin said there, y'all, is really applicable to not just your business partner, but the employees you're hiring or the boss that you're looking for to go work for a company or your friends. Of start with values and then be able to bring the different talents, temperaments, and convictions that each of you have to the table to be able to work towards that vision that has been inspired together. So I think that's really great. And Kevin, as we start kind of moving towards the end of the show, I like the idea of bringing it back a little bit to the graduate school and higher education. You mentioned that you have a PhD in professional counseling. Talk to me about how you approach conflict within your business, having that professional background, understanding how people work and conflict resolution. And do you feel like that's an invaluable skill to have on the team, or do you feel like you end up turning into a counselor at work?
Well, I try not to become a counselor at work, but I find that I'm trying to figure out how to sort of distill this down into a relatable answer. I find that when there's conflict, there's roots to that conflict. When you got weeds in the garden, there's roots underneath it. You don't want to just, you know, cut the dandelions. You want to get at root causes. And so, you know, for me, it's under, you know, what I'm often doing is trying to do some type of a root cause analysis of what's generating this emotional energy in this particular, and it could be one of our franchisees, it could be an employee. What's going on here? Like trying to understand where's the emotional energy coming from? And then, not to go too deep, but like just recently, I've had a couple of members who are really, really upset about various things. And so getting on a Zoom call or a phone call, you can get a lot of traction with what's called co-regulation of emotion, right? And so if I can mirror, there's some neural mirroring that goes on, emotion to get the sort of emotion I want, I can move them out of their limbic system into their prefrontal cortex, right? Less emotional thinking and more cognition thinking, which then lends itself to much more productive conversation. And it's amazing how you can help a person get to a much better spot when you are able to do a little root cause analysis, get them out of their feeling brain and into their thinking brain, into a productive conversation to, hey, here's how I think we can address this. And you do it really in a collaborative format. The team, it's funny, even yesterday, they were saying, well, Kevin's got the silver tongue. Have him talk to them. He needs to talk to them. People always come out happy after they talk to him. But I think part of it is just, you know, recognizing some of the emotional quotient of okay, where's this person at? How do I help them regulate their emotion to get to a spot where we can have a real productive conversation and lend itself to a better outcome? And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's not so much counseling of, hey, let me solve your problems as much as how can I help this person navigate their emotions to get to a spot where we can have a productive conversation that then they feel better about the outcome. So, and I do lean into that thinking often. In the recruiting process, sometimes it's the opposite. You want to trigger some emotion to see how they navigate it. So, and that's part of the vetting process.
This right here is why we recommend understanding neuroscience and psychology and understanding how human beings operate. Neuroscience undergrad for myself and worked in behavioral healthcare for years before all this. And Dan loves reading this kind of stuff and just understanding that we're feeling beings that think, not thinking beings that feel, and how you can navigate that. And the way Kevin summarized that is just fantastic. So understanding human behavior is a necessary component of business because business is not that hard. It's all the soft skills that are the most important part of business in general. But I think that was a
well, think about it.
Great.
When you go to buy an off-market property, typically you're buying an off-market property from someone who doesn't want to list. Well, they don't want to list it because something's going on in their life, right? And it's that relationship and helping that person solve a problem and then getting, you know, crawling into their skin, into their boots and understand what's going on. I mean, those are soft skills. I mean, understanding where that person is and what they're experiencing lends itself to being able to negotiate pennies on the dollar to purchase that property in such a way that they walk away not feeling taken advantage of. But I help them solve a problem and we've both got a better future because of
it. Oh, yeah.
So it's not just in your business, it's how you conduct your business with the customers.
Absolutely. Well, getting you know, back to psych 101 of just understanding their needs of they're not able to comprehend this higher order of thinking and moving into the PFC of navigating a complex real estate transaction in their mind whenever they aren't able to feed their kid because they have all of these other issues. So it's being able to get out of your head and understand human behavior and how to use it in your marriage, with your kids, in your business, with your partners, or the clients that you're doing it, doing any sort of business with.
Yeah, the whole time you were talking there, Kevin, we could talk for hours. I was thinking of Behave by Robert Sapolsky, which is one that Mason recommended to me that I read, which is a dense book, but a lot of useful insight into how we think, how we operate, and how to effectively communicate with other people. So, which really is probably the most essential skill in business and sales, right? Sales is just understanding how to navigate human emotion and communicate effectively to get to a common objective. So anyways, Kevin, we're running out of time. That was a lot of fun. So redbarnhomebuyers.com is the website for your franchise. Anywhere else where you'd like to direct people or anything else you'd like to say to our audience?
Yeah, so you can go there. You can go to redbarnfranchise.com. Go to our YouTube page. We got a great YouTube page. Go to YouTube and look up Red Barn Home Buyers, where we got a bunch of valuable videos, a lot of just interviews, testimonials. You know, Ken and I out in the field spending time with folks. But yeah, if it's something that somebody's interested in pursuing, you can call me. I tell you what, I will give you my personal mobile number. the tens of thousands of people that are going to listen to this week, if you are interested in learning more, you can call my mobile phone number that's in my pocket at 404-423-9252. And I might not know who you are, but I will either get your text message or pick up the phone and talk to you. But that's my personal number if you want.
That's awesome. And mom, Mrs. Haberkamp, if you guys are listening, feel free to give Kevin a call on that. But Kevin, this has been an absolute blast. We've had a ton of fun. All of the links that you just mentioned are going to be in the show notes as well. We won't put your personal cell phone number in the show notes. They have to listen to this point.
You absolutely can if you want to. I am totally fine. You put my personal number in there.
Heck yeah. Well, we appreciate your generosity and the time that you spent with us and all of the great advice you gave for ourselves as well as our audience. But this is Mason McDonald and Dan Haberkamp with the Big Picture Blueprint signing off. And that's it for today's episode of the Big Picture Blueprint. If you found it helpful, please share it with your friends or anyone you think that it could benefit. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a rating, and we'll see you in the next episode.